This week on the Auto Trader Podcast.
What's interesting is it's not an entry-level car. It's not seen as an entry-level car. It's now an aspirational entry-level car.
Aspirational entry-level. That's like a new segment. What do you reckon of that, Reino?
I don't even know where to start with that, but aspirational entry. Well, considering the way car prices are going these days, I think almost every car is aspirational.
At this point, yeah. I have two very esteemed colleagues with me today. We have the man with a camera, the man with an eye for photography, and so much more things, especially Italian stuff. We have Mr. Reino Ferri.
Hello.
And then we have the center of attention and reporting from Cape Town itself, telling us everything that's going on that side. It's an A. You're on the big TV screen. How do you feel?
Very nervous and very magnified.
No, you're all good here. You're all good. So welcome to another episode of the Auto Trader Podcast. Today's episode, Fuel Sippers. What are we going to be talking about exactly? First up, with Heart or Not, we're going to be talking about Anae's experience with the Kia Picanto, which was launched recently in Cape Town. Next up with Yes But No, we're going to be discussing whether the Honda CR-V is actually worth a million rand. And then, with Heat Seekers, Anae is going to talk about the Isuzu One Tank Challenge and some fuel-saving tips. And last but not least, an Ask Auto Trader question. So, let us get right into it with Hot or Not. Anae, Cape Town is a lovely place. Naturally aspirated cars of no turbos, for those that were not aware. Feel really good in Cape Town. So, how was the Picanto? Tell us all about it.
Well, the Picanto is a great little car. It's always been a great little car. And The most noteworthy thing about it, it's probably its price tag. It's still a 1.1 liter naturally aspirated car, as you've already mentioned. And then, of course, you also have the 1.2. So not much has changed from an engine perspective. They've added a lot of specs to it, and it's completely new from the outside. I mean, it looks completely new and slick and suave. And it's a lovely little car. It gives people status. I think what's interesting is it's not an entry-level car. It's not seen as an entry-level car. It's now an aspirational entry-level car.
Aspirational entry-level. That's like a new segment. What do you reckon of that, Reino?
I don't even know where to start with that, but aspirational entry. Well, considering the way car prices are going these days, I think almost every car is aspirational.
At this point,
In terms of like the styling, like Anae said, like from the pictures and everything that I've seen, it absolutely looks like very premium. And very sporty. So I'm quite excited to see once we get our test model up here in Joburg.
We'll see how it fares.
Yeah.
And I think this is the other thing about it as well. It's this is the thing I've noticed with super minis, if I can call them, like the Kia Picantos, your Grand i10s and all that. It seems a lot of like lifestyle people get into them, like your yoga teachers, your Pilates teachers and all that. I've known so many who drive a Picanto or Grand i10 of that nature of sorts. Anae, do you think, especially like in the Western Cape, because there's a lot of lifestyle people there, we had a fun chat about that at launch once. Do you think a lot of people will get into that since it's an aspirational entry vehicle?
Well, I never knew this before, but Kia says that their target market for this car is your 26 to 32-year-olds. Oh. So young and upcoming professionals. I think in the 90s we used to call them yuppies. That is no longer a thing. But I'm giving my age away. But the entry level is just under 261,000 bucks. So that's no matric or student has that kind of money. I mean, not even we do. So it's definitely got, remember, people always used to drive Golfs. That was the thing. And then Golfs became expensive, and then they were driving Polos. And now it seems, with the way things are going, the Picanto is the car to be seen in. So it's interesting. Interesting turn of events.
We'll look forward to that when we get the car up on test. Now, let's move on to Yes But No. So the Honda CR-V. It's really surprised a lot of people in that its price tag. it's R1 million. And I had the exclusive model on test, which is the top of the range model. You're looking at about R1,050,000. And I thought, okay, if Honda is going to be charging this much, this has better got to be an experience. That made no sense English-wise, but anyways. But this is the thing. Unfortunately, I came out a bit disappointed, if I'm being perfectly honest. And the reason why is because, look, I was impressed with the Honda Fit Hybrid. Such a lovely little car, and it got to the point where I was actually looking at finance for that particular vehicle. And then I thought, you know what, this would probably be the same with the CR-V, because I'm like, you know, this is going to be Honda Premium. We know that there's so much craftsmanship that goes into details, which you might even miss to some degree. But then I jumped in and I was like, this is it? But that got me wondering, what actually makes a R1 million a R1 million car? I mean, the spectrum has changed quite a bit, especially considering car pricing that we've mentioned. But guys, shoot the breeze here. And Nate, you go first, because ladies first. What do you think?
Well, I'll probably just buy a Toyota at the end of the day, because number one, they're built right here in South Africa. Look how cheap the Toyota Corolla Cross Hybrid is compared to everything else that's out there.
Yeah.
And you're getting that huge fuel saving. I mean, I'm just not even going to be looking at anything else at this point. I'm going to be buying a Toyota Hybrid in some shape or form.
Because that's the other thing with the CR-V. You'd expect for a mil, it would at least be a hybrid, which it's not. It's powered by a 1.5-liter turbo VTEC motor, 140 kilowatts, 240 newtons, and it's connected to a CVT box, power center to the front wheels, which, look, it's not a bad powertrain. I think it drives perfectly fine. But the thing is, it doesn't scream R1 million to me. That's the thing about it. Especially when you consider that the CR-V, if I'm not mistaken, the previous one, the top of the range, which was the 2-liter premium CVT, that was around the 700K range. But then when we look at the likes of, let's say, the Mitsubishi Outlander, for example, if you guys have seen it, I sit there and I think, this is nearly 300K cheaper for a mid-spec model, which has four-wheel drive and pretty much the same accoutrement as what the CR-V offers. But then that makes me think, okay, what would actually cause a disparity in price like that? Reyno, what do you reckon about this?
So I haven't personally interacted with that CR-V. You must not tell me how much plastic trimmings are there, how much, like, if you feel around, does it feel premium enough?
That's the thing. It feels premium. Like, everything that you touch and feel, there's a lot of soft touch materials. The thing feels well put together. It's even got active noise canceling inside of it as well for, you know, to manage the NVH and all of that. But then when I operate a lot of the switchgear and everything, I sit there and I think, this feels 700K, not a mil at least. Like, jumping into the likes of the German competitors, for example, let's take your BMW X1. You sit there and you think, okay, I'm getting my money's worth here. Whereas at the CR-V, I sit there and I think, this is a solid car, definitely, but it's solid at 700K. You ever get that feeling, guys?
No, 100%. I think personally, if you think like from a business perspective, Honda South Africa imports everything.
Yeah.
They're not building anything here. BMW, on the other hand, has a plant in Rosslyn.
Aha.
So they get basically credits and rebates, and that's why they can sell their cars at a little bit of a lower rate than what a Honda or an equivalent Honda is going to be. Unfortunately, the CR-V, I think, is just exposed to a lot of taxes.
Yeah.
So I think anywhere else you might actually get it for the 700K. It's because of that import taxes and that goes on top that basically makes it a R1 million car.
The R1 million Honda, we've gotten to this extent. Although that Civic Type R, lovely though. But anyways, moving on. So we are going to chat about the Isuzu One Tank Challenge and Heat Seekers. And A, you wrote something about this on site, which please go and search our articles on site. We write very lovely stuff. And A, please talk about that.
Well, they always do one. Almost every year they've been doing it for the last couple of years. And they do one tank of diesel in the entry-level, or well, 1.9-liter turbo diesel Isuzu, which is, of course, now the D-Max. And they'd set off in Joburg, and they try and reach Cape Town, Signal Hill to be exact, with on one tank of diesel. And everyone's managed to do it. I think the poorest performers managed to reach the Winelands one stop. But still, it's like 1,400-something kilometers on one tank of diesel.
Wow.
So They're getting figures like 5 to 6 liters per 100 kilometers, which is like 18, 19 kilometers to the liter, which is fantastic. Wow. So basically what they did was they didn't drive too fast, obviously. So they stuck around the sort of highway limit, which is about like between 100 and 120 Ks. And obviously when you're doing sort of that kind of road trip, you really have to concentrate. You can't accelerate too fast. You can't lose momentum. You can't have extra stuff in the car that's going to make it heavy. So there's a lot of things that you have to do to almost hypermile in order to get as much mileage out of one tank.
Interesting.
Go to the loo often.
That as well. But then that's the thing also with the, especially with diesel motors I've seen. I mean, a lot of people say this. They'll say if you're going to be doing the Joburg to Cape Town trip often, it's always the case of just get yourself a diesel, you're sorted. You don't even need to think about it. But now with the advent of hybrid diesel cars, that's coming up also. I know Toyota's doing something with the Hilux. It's a mild hybrid vehicle, and then some other things are coming up too. So
Mazda with a CX-60 as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that as well. That's another one. So I sit there and I think, okay, how much more frugal can diesel actually get at this point? I mean, we're talking about basic diesel engines and the Isuzu, as you mentioned now, with the 1.9 and that. But then it also makes me wonder as well, the kind of hypermiling, what do people actually do to hypermiling? And I think the perfect person to talk to about this is Mr. Rayner right here, because every time he's had a long-term vehicle, we don't know how he does it. How?
So it's pretty much what Anay just said earlier. It's really about maintaining momentum, and it's about reading the traffic ahead of you. So you did an ideal situation, and believe it or not, you don't want to use your brakes ever. So you want to actually, as you go down an incline, you want the engine to brake you. So you're not using the accelerator, meaning you're not using fuel. And going up a hill, you want to carry enough momentum so that as you go up the hill, you're not slow enough and you don't have to use a lot of fuel to sort of build the momentum again. So it's literally as much as you can try and read the traffic and everything ahead of you, as well as the undulations in the sort of road ahead, and just work with that. Recently, we almost did that trip with the electric cars down to Cape Town. And with that, we even measured the wind direction and the wind speed. So yeah,
actually does make a difference. Yeah.
So you can get into a lot of detail, but ultimately, just read the traffic ahead of you.
Or Rayner, you can drive with your left wheels on the yellow line. So it's less rolling resistance.
All these techniques. I mean, Rayner, you even had the extremely potent Audi RS6 Avant. Now, how much fuel did you use in that?
So initially, obviously, I've commuted just back and forth, and I just looked at sort of what the fuel consumption is. I achieved, I think, 10.5 liters per 100, which for a 4-liter twin turbo V8 is not bad at all. obviously, there was some short stints in some parts of the world.
As you would.
that you'd push that up quickly to like 25 to 35 liters per 100. Obviously, that's driving a little bit more spirited, in a spirited fashion.
Anay, what would you recommend, both, let's say, in a sports car situation and when you've really made an effort to save a bit of fuel? What do you generally do? Because I know Western Cape has a lot of hills. So managing that, as Rayner said, there's undulations in the road and that. How do you actually sort that out?
Well, I mean, it makes a huge difference. So if you've got a car like, let's say, a Volvo, and you use the sat nav, it will automatically adjust your throttle to wherever you're driving. So it will actually ease off in the right places, as opposed to normal cruise control that won't ease off as you're going down a hill. And it will anticipate bends in the road, and it will prime everything in order to be as efficient as possible. But when I don't have a Volvo or anything as advanced, I normally just, as Rayner said, try to keep momentum, very, very gentle acceleration before you go up a hill, and easing off as you come down. Don't put anything on the roof if you're going anywhere for wind resistance. make sure your tires are inflated at sort of their upper limits. You want to make sure your tires are never underinflated because that will be detrimental. What else can you do? Also, if you visited the nursery and you purchased a whole bunch of potting soil and rocks for your rock garden, please remove it before setting off on any journeys.
So we go to the nursery, we leave it behind because we had to save fuel to get back. It's a very interesting brief story that I remember, like just regarding start-stop systems. Like this was the time when they were starting to come into swing. So I was at a McDonald's drive-thru getting a cheeky lunch. And then there was this fellow in his half-ton of buggy. And there was quite a long queue, as you'd expect for lunchtime at a drive-thru. And then every time he used to go like a little up in the queue, he turned on the car, started quickly while the engine is circulating oil because, you know, it revs up a little bit higher, move quickly, turn it off. He does that again, repeated for like the next hour or so. And I sat there and I thought, I get that he understands the concept of start-stop systems, but in the same breath, I know the car that he was driving was not exactly engineered for that.
Yeah.
But in your guys' experience, have you actually saved fuel when it comes to start-stop systems? I've noticed in one of the cars that I've tested, the Subaru Crosstrek, interestingly, it tells you how many mils or liters of fuel you've actually saved, let's say in a recorded period, that you can actually save from using the systems. But I don't know, some people think it's a bit of snake oil, but is there actually truth to it?
I think from a if you're sitting in a traffic between Johannesburg and Pretoria, for instance, and it's like back to back and it's constantly stop, go, stop, go. I think in a situation like that, it possibly could help you out a little bit, because in that 2 minutes or 3 minutes that you're standing still, you're not burning any fuel. But obviously, I'm skeptical that you'll save a lot of fuel if there's flowing traffic and it's just robot stops. Yeah. I mean, if you're going to save 30 seconds of idling, I don't think it's going to make that big of a difference in your at the end of the month.
I guess so. You reckon the same in there?
No, it's a horrible thing that stops system. I usually switch it off. It's the first thing I switch off. So no, I don't think it really warrants, using it. And it's not a huge selling point for me on a car. And I know also of mechanics who say that it can be damaging to your timing chain in the long run. Not that I'm a mechanic, but that's what I've heard them say. So no, I don't think it's worth the trouble.
Well, there you go. There's some tips to save a bit of fuel because at least petrol is decreasing next month. Anyways, moving on. Last but not least, we have an Ask Auto Trader question. And this one comes from Jay Snyders. A little bit of a loaded question. So let me scroll down here. I look so professional. Thank you so much. He says, hi, I'm looking into buying a VW Golf 1.4 TSI DSG Cabriolet. I know the car is a bit old. Any tips? Is it wise in 2024? What type of motor plan cover would I need? What mileage range do I need to look at? And that's the question. First things first, I remember the Cabriolet era quite vividly, and then every car was a Cabriolet to some extent. Would you guys ever get into that? Just not not like bespoke Cabriolet, like an MX-5 or a Porsche Cayenne or something. Just let's just take a hatchback and make it into one.
Nate?
Well, I remember driving a Range Rover Evoque that was a Cabriolet. Oh. You can still find them on Auto Trader, and I thought that was a hoot. You can go off-roading and you can put the top down. So for me, that was brilliant. But I don't know if I would buy one to like drive from Monday to Friday. No, probably not.
I guess it's also a bit of a lifestyle thing. But to answer your question, Mr. Jay Snyders, so this is the thing with the DSG. So we did a little bit of research, naturally, as you would. So considering that you mentioned that you're looking at the TSI, so not the GTI in that instance, if I'm reading that correctly, there were two variants of the TSI engines. There was a 90 kilowatt variant and there was a 118 kilowatt variant. And according to what some people have said, the 90 kilowatt version is the variant to have because it's just turbocharging alone. Because I know with Volkswagen's TSI motors in particular, I speak under correction, it depends on the engine, but then the 118 kilowatt variant had both turbocharging and supercharging. So some people have regarded it as a component that can potentially fail. So that's something to look at if you're going to be looking at that vehicle in particular. But then also the DSG boxes, interestingly. It's not just the GTIs that will suffer from it. It isn't exactly inherent of the car itself. It's mostly because of the drivers. People go and flog the things and expect it to be happy the next day. It's not going to be. But that's another thing just to check out as well. And then considering that you're getting a cabriolet, at least make sure the mechanicals of the cabriolet system, the folding top, actually work properly. They've been lubricated, greased, and are functioning correctly as you'd expect with that sort of thing. Apart from that, let's also talk motor plans quickly. So I checked on sites just on what's available with the Golf cabriolets, and I've seen that a lot of them range from the 100,000 kilometer range to 200,000 Ks. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, with the majority of motor plan and service plan offerings these days, the car must be younger than 10 years. And you cannot have a mileage of over 250,000 Ks. I know it differs from plan to plan, but then I sit there and I think, okay, if you want to get this car, Mr. Snyders, you need to take that into account with the mileage in particular and the age of this vehicle. So apart from that, in terms of service and all, if you're going to be maintaining it yourself, by all means, and you know what you're getting yourself into, I mean, it's a fun lifestyle vehicle. Why not? Who doesn't love a top down? But guys, what do you say?
I would jump in here and I would say it would be a good idea for this mister to call his insurance company and just inquire in general, how much more premium does a cabriolet carry over the normal hatchback in terms of its monthly installment or the premiums that he's going to have to pay? Because I think that might also, it is more classified as a sports car than it is a hatchback. And I think that might push the premium up slightly. Yeah. And then secondly, I would also look at the roof, the material itself. If the material is old, it can actually tear quickly. So even if the mechanism works well, the material could have faded over time. So you must just be very careful for that as well. Yes, Anay?
Yes.
Yeah, especially if it's a car's been standing in the sun. And you can always take it to get Decra tested if you're unsure about the mechanics. And the other thing is, a DSG gearbox is very expensive to replace. So I would definitely have somebody taking a good look at that gearbox. It was a few years ago. I think it was 25,000 just to replace that. So I don't know how much it costs now.
Yeah.
And to do it properly, no less. That's the other thing.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that answers it. I hope that answers your question, man. But that's all the time we have for now. So thank you very much for watching this AT podcast with Mr. Reino Faree and all the way in Cape Town. You didn't tell us about the weather, eh? What's happening here?
It's sunny. It's still sunny. We haven't had the torrential downpours yet, but we're bracing ourselves.
South African weather is very confusing and very bipolar. So, yeah, come and visit us, international people. But anyways, that's it for now. Thank you very much for watching. Please don't forget to like, share, and subscribe. And hit that notification bell so you never miss another episode or even review on the Auto Trader YouTube channel and more. Go and search the site for used and new offerings. And I don't know what else to say. So, cheers. Search Auto Trader.